holding a work session today on Senate Bill 290. I want to go ahead and begin with a brief public hearing on Senate Bill 863. So let me go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 863. And I've got three witnesses sign up on the sign-up sheet. If you would like to come forward, please. I've got Don Schellenberg, Dave Von Ash, and David Tongas. Request for invitation on this bill isn't getting a real reception.
Which is this one?
The other folks in the sign-up sheet want to come on up and...
Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau, joining me today, and most on your list, Larry Wells on the far, my far left, Dave Vash. Okay. And Dave Tongas. Appreciate the opportunity to come before you today regarding Senate Bill 863. If ever there was an issue that signified common sense and fairness, it is the issue in this bill. When a landowner purchases a parcel that contains a dwelling, the increased value of the dwelling site is automatically included in the price. In the farm zone, the new landowner may or may not need or even want the dwelling when the land is purchased. However, if the dwelling is removed for safety or any other reason and not replaced within 2 years, the landowner may lose the ability to ever replace the dwelling again. The result would be the loss of the value of the dwelling site that the landowner paid when it was purchased. The solution is to allow the landowner to obtain a certificate from the county which would allow the dwelling to be replaced at any time in the future. In the end, if the dwelling is replaced, there would be no more dwellings in the farm zone than otherwise existed anyway, and there may even be fewer if the landowner never needs to replace the dwelling. The bill only allows the permit to be transferred to a family member, so the permit does not function as an investment opportunity. Thank you again for the hearing today. The Oregon Farm Bureau asks that you send Senate Bill 863 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. I have, Mr. Chairman, another piece of paper being handed to you that I'd like to read into the record. This is from Bruce Andrews, former Director of the Department of Agriculture here and under previous administration. And he writes, "Don, please express my full support for OFB position on farm replacement dwellings. Farmers are often vexed with the problem of older houses on acquired or inherited farmland. These buildings, often run down, under current law, require farmers to keep them if they want to preserve their rights to rebuild and occupy, lease, or provide to family members in the future. These buildings should be removed if conditions warrant and a replacement credit issued by local government for future building consideration. Maintaining these structures is expensive and can become an attractive nuisance for criminal behavior. Clearly, providing the farmer landowner with building replacement credit allows the landowner the opportunity to build a replacement dwelling when conditions and financing warrant. This bill does nothing to undermine the intent of land use planning, but recognizes the practical considerations of maintaining or replacing an existing structure. I urge passage of this bill. Thank you, Bruce Andrews." He would like to be here today, but he's out of state all week this week, and so asked me to present that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Who wants to go next?
Chairman Ringel and committee members, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Dave Van Ash. I live in Cornelius, Oregon, and I and my family farm about 2,300 acres there. And the family owns about 630 acres. And you'll see a picture of the dwelling there that I gave you. I and my wife bought this property. It's 140 acres in two parcels. The one with the house on it there is about 90. In 1996, and we paid the appraised value for the property, and the appraisal included the value of the dwelling, or at least the dwelling site. And then we went ahead and got a replacement dwelling permit from the county, although we had no intention of building or replacing the dwelling. We just kind of did that to preserve the site and to protect our appraised the money that we'd spent on the site. And the problem with the replacement dwelling permit is it's only good for 2 years. And this is an old house. It was that was lived in until about the mid-90s when we bought the house. And you know, like I said, the permit is expired now. And we don't have any intention of building anything there for our family members immediately. But at some time in the future, if my son or daughter who are involved in our farm wanted a building site or a house, you know, it's a good site for it. And we would just like the ability, like Don said, to be able to put this permit into our deed, and if at some point in the future we needed it, it would be available to us.
So, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Larry Wells. I live down in the southern Marion County area. And through the years, I have torn down two of these houses and have lived next to two of these houses. The two I tore down, economic issues really came in. One was on my grandfather's farm that I was farming. And I tore down all the houses on that farm and cleaned up the barns and everything. And then just a few years later, when my mother kind of decided to split up our holdings, she let my brother have that farm. And he had really a hard time then coming back and putting a house back on that farm. But that was an established house site that had been there for years. And then I had bought a piece of land right next to it and had paid quite a bit for that house site again because I wanted that piece of ground, and then I tore that house down. And economically, that really came back and bit me when I lost that house site. I have driven by two houses for the last 20 years that have sat on property next to me. I think it was because of Farm Credit or VA that had financing on that property, basically did not want to lose those house sites. But those house sites just sit there on that property through the years, run down, but they were trying to preserve the house site. So I see a real aesthetic issue here that we need to clean up some of these old houses out there and allow then eventually that house site to be preserved for that owner.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Barr.
Mr. Vinash, I'm just curious. Sounds like you might have a Measure 37 claim. You going to file one?
Well, we bought the property in 1996.
But there was a house there and had a right to build on it when you bought it, and Measure 37 would be...
Replacement dwellings, and there were statutes on the books and regulations in place dealing with replacement dwellings in 96. I expect those regulations are probably the same ones that existed in 96 that are still on the books today.
I believe so. I would say, going along with Larry, is there's a lot of these old dwellings in Washington County where I live. In fact, as there was a couple more of them that I contacted the owners yesterday, and I thought they were going to have some testimony today, but they don't, and they are eyesores. And, you know, as farmers, we tend to become slumlords because you don't want to put a whole lot of money into them if you're still renting them, but because you don't want to lose the site. But in reality, we'd rather just tear them down and farm over the site until we need them again in the future, if we ever need them.
Mr. Thomas?
Hi. Senator Ringo and committee chair members. We have a family farm. Our farm, our family has been farming since around the 1940s in Washington County. And I gave each of you this morning a sheet here with, we have three parcels there that have these houses that we are talking about this bill. They don't look that bad, but we're more or less in the farming business, not into the rental business, and we just would like the right to remove the houses and have that on the deed, and instead of, you know, trying to maintain these houses for rentals. So that's that we're having so much trouble with vandalism and that type of, you know, activity going around for the houses that, you know, we try to keep them secured, so for liability reasons, but the people just keep breaking into them and, you know, vandalizing them, and so that's where we're, our point there, so thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions from the committee? Okay, well, this was for a public hearing only. We're not going to move the bill today, but I really appreciate all of your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 863. I wanted to open a work session on Senate Bill 538. Linda, are you here? Linda Swarish? And Senator Westland, do you, Senator Westland, you're here for this bill, I assume?
Correct.
Would you like to come up and inform us? We have the Dash 2 amendments. Or are you just giving moral support by sitting in the audience and making sure we're going to do the right thing?
Ron Eber from the OCD as well.
Okay, Ron.
I might want to come up.
Somebody tell us what the Dash 1 amendments do and the Dash 2 amendments do.
You've got the Dash 1s and 2s? Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Eber, Farm Forest Land Specialist for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. The guest ranch legislation, I believe, began in 1997 and has allowed a number of guest ranches to be approved in eastern Oregon. I think this bill is, again, an attempt to improve on the bill, which has been the intent over time, and why it I think for several sessions the sunset date has been extended in the reporting requirement of the department, and the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Economic Development have.
No, just excuse me. The initial bill would remove the sunset. The Dash 2 amendments extend the sunset out to 2010.
Correct. There would be an extension of the sunset.
All right.
And a continuation of the reporting requirement, which then gives us a chance to see how it's working and make adjustments on a periodic basis. And so this bill does that one more time.
All right. And if we adopt the Dash 2 amendments, is there any reason to adopt the Dash 1 amendment? My staff is saying no.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe all the Dash 1s do is extend the sunset out to 2010.
Yeah. All right. The Dash 2 amendments extend the sunset and impose the reporting requirement you just discussed.
That's correct.
All right, so we need the Dash 2 amendments.
Are we in work session?
We are in work session. I guess, committee, are there any questions about the effect of the Dash 2 amendments? Okay.
Mr. Chair,
we are in work session.
Move the Dash 2 amendments.
Senator Atkinson has moved the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 538. Are there any questions? Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, the bill is amended.
Pass.
Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 538 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Yes?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westland.
Ben Westland, Senate District 27. I prepared 2 hours of riveting testimony. Sure would be appropriate at this time. Perhaps it could change your mind.
And Mr. Chair,
do you think we should just go ahead and recess this bill? And
on second thought,
Mr. Chair, perhaps.
Senator, would you like to testify or would you like the bill?
I'd like the bill, sir.
There's been a motion to move Senate Bill 538 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Seeing no objections, so ordered. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very good. That's the best tie I've ever seen you have, Senator.
Can I borrow yours for just a moment?
You need a tie?
Yeah.
Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1037. Director Shetterly, would you like to... I'm sorry. Before we do that, why don't we let our committee staff, Chris Crane, summarize what we have before us. Let's do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We
email Friday afternoon, and it's been available in other ways and other places. There's a draft of a proposed amendment dated May 6th and entitled Senate Bill 1037-2. This has been submitted to Legislative Council, and it's the proposal we will be discussing today. The first thing folks may notice is that it jumps directly from Section 1 to Section 4. That, in my haste to get this out, this is why the legislature hires copy editors. At any rate, the bill, there's also been a summary distributed. I'll just track real quickly through some of the bill's more significant provisions. The first section deals with what we're referring to as a tract of record, and it simply allows a person, if they don't already have a house on their property, it allows them to apply for a dwelling on a property under whatever the standards were that applied at the time you purchased the property. So this is very, very similar to what Measure 37 does for single-family dwellings. Jumping then to Section 4, if you will, this is Measure 37 is amended to conform with the other provisions of this bill, some of the more significant amendments that folks want to be aware of. The first thing we do is apply Measure 37 to land use regulations and adopt a definition of land use regulations that includes what people typically historically think of as land use regulations, statutes and ORS chapters 215 and 197, the rules of LCDC, but also is expanded to include the Forest Practices Act and rules of the Board of Forestry and Chapter 561 Department of Agriculture statutes and regulations. There is still a short list of exemptions on page 2. It's subsection 3
about 37.
And you can see much of it is the first several are existing exemptions, and then there are a number of exemptions added. Keep in mind, these are things that would otherwise be considered land use regulations under the bill, but for any number of reasons, these are land use regulations exempt from 37. In subsection 5 at the bottom of page 2, top of page 3, are new provisions dealing with when you file a claim. Very briefly, for retroactive claims, they would need to be brought within 60 days. I think we were going to change that. The current proposal is 60. I think there was a suggestion to change that to 180 days to conform with the legislature's printing process for the ORS. So when the bill's generally available, people would know what the filing deadline is. For regulations adopted after the effective date of the Act, if you bring in a facial challenge to the regulation, you would have 2 years to bring the claim. If it is an as-applied challenge, you'd have 60 days from the date the regulation is applied. And 5 years after land use regulation is adopted, then any Measure 37 claims would be cut off. It's known as a statute of ultimate repose. Figure after 5 years, somebody's going to know what the regulation is. I want to get this on the record in case it survives intact. The transferability provision is found currently in subsection 8 of Measure 37, where the language says that a public entity may waive land use regulations, quote, to allow the owner to use the property for use permitted at the time the owner acquired the property. And that's been interpreted by many, including the Attorney General, to mean that the rights gained under a waiver are not transferable. By removing the words "the owner to use the property for," the intent here is to allow the land use waiver to become transferable. Any development pursuant to a Measure 37 waiver would still be subject to whatever land use regulations apply after the waiver, so you'd still go back through the land use process, and the local government would still have the ability to review and approve whatever it is that's being proposed. Definitions start on page 5, section 6. Again, this lists our traditional land use regulations, but includes Board of Forestry, Department of Agriculture. Section 7 is the claims process. Some things to note here: we set out exactly what has the minimum standards really for what has to be in a claim, and it's pretty straightforward. We did not include significantly that a claim include a title report, and we did not require that a claim include an appraisal. Many claims are simply just too small to justify that expense, although certainly that's information that would be helpful. We borrowed the completeness review process from the existing land use regulations, so when somebody comes in to and submits a claim,
the public entity has 180 days from the date the claim is submitted, assuming it's a complete claim, and they have enough information then to render a decision. And sometimes there is no contention over whether or not a claim is complete. So we just borrow the existing process for determining when a claim is complete for purposes of starting the 180-day clock. We included a requirement that public notice be given when a claim is received. A public hearing is not required, but is optional for the public entity if they so choose. But the public has to have opportunity to comment. So there's a notice and comment requirement. Agencies and local governments are given authority to adopt a fee, not to exceed $1,000, so the fee is capped. And state agencies are given authority to waive state statutes. That's a question of constitutional proportions, but I know the AG, at least in another context, in another venue, has opined that agencies do have authority to waive state statutes. We have provisions on page 8, subsection 15, for joint application. If you want to submit your land use application and Measure 37 claim all at the same time, how is that handled by a public entity? In page 9, sub 17, decision to waive land use regulations. In other words, a waiver decision expires after 10 years, so these things aren't just hanging out for generations. Judicial review, section 8, would be on the record, developed before the public entity. Anyone who's adversely affected could otherwise establish standing, may intervene. Significantly, anybody who participated in the Measure 37 review process will get notice if there's a claim filed in the circuit court. We divide farmland into three categories: high value, non-high value, and non-resource land. Working now from the summary dated May 9th that people may have available. Category 1 includes high value farmland. The definition of high value farmland is, the existing statutory definition is amended somewhat. This is found now in section 11 on page 10 of May 6th draft. Non-resource land, currently it says in the Willamette Valley is composed of class 6 through 8 soils, outside the valley 7 and 8 soils. I believe the intent was for it to be 7 and 8 soils also in the Willamette Valley, but I neglected to pick up, to change the Roman numeral from a Roman 6 to a Roman 7. I don't speak Latin either. Land divisions and land uses are dealt with differently in each, and Measure 37 dealt with differently in each category. In Category 1, retroactive Measure 37 claims would not be allowed. Prospective Measure 37 claims would be allowed. And again, the definition of high value is amended. On non-high value, prospective Measure 37 claims would be allowed for regulations that restrict residential use of the property. If you don't want to go through the Measure 37 process, you can, and you otherwise would have a valid Measure 37 claim, you can apply to petition or subdivide your property down to 20-acre minimums or whatever the minimum size was when you purchased your property. Or we created a clustering provision, and this would allow a person, in lieu of 20 acres minimum lot sizes, to subdivide the property or partition it down to one new land unit for every 10 acres, but those new units would have to be clustered. They'd have to average 2 acres. So, for example, if you had an 80-acre parcel, you could get 7 new lots, plus the remainder would be 8, one for every 10 acres. But the 7 new lots would have to be clustered together. We put sideboards on them. You'd have to look. This is found in the draft, for section 13, starting at page 12 on to page 14. The new lots can't be large. Average size should be 2 acres, should be contiguous to each other, 50 feet from streams, the other sideboards. On category 3 land, the Measure 37 would only apply to local regulations that exceed the requirements of state law. 20-acre minimum lot size on category 3 lands. Any uses allowed by Goal 14, so all the limitations on uses imposed under Goals 3 and Goal 4 would be removed. It amounts to a legislative grant of exception, Goal 3 and 4 exception, to all of these non-resource lands. So any use allowed by Goal 14, in other words, rural uses, commercial, industrial, whatever might be allowed under Goal 14 would be allowed in Category 3 lands, regardless of whether or not you had a Measure 37 claim. Also, there are some counties out there that have designated non-resource land under the existing LCDC rules, and those lands will be allowed to be transferred into this new non-resource category just by local legislative process. in forest land. No retroactive Measure 37 claims. All claims would be prospective only, with one exception. For small property owners, if you have, say, a 40-acre parcel of forest land, you may partition that. And partition by statute means the creation of three or fewer parcels. So you could create three new parcels and put a house on each one. This is to really to facilitate development and allow some recovery for people who just purchased a small property that was then zoned forest land. Urban growth boundaries, Measure 37, would be prospective only, with the exception of retroactive claims would be allowed against local regulations, land use regulations that restrict the residential use of property that were adopted under what is known as Goal 5, the LCDC rule protecting scenic values, cultural resources, wildlife resources, and so on inside the urban growth boundary. Then we have a provision dealing with the urban fringe within 1 mile of small cities, 2 miles of larger cities, to allow more planned development on the edges of urban areas, would require within the first 9 months following the effective date of this bill, no Measure 37 claims would be submitted within that 9 months while the local government designated, whether we're referring to study areas or reserve areas, whatever language you prefer, for, and these are areas where it's expected the urban growth boundary will expand within the next 10 years. After the 9 months, if something's not designated as a study or reserve area, it's subject then to the remaining provisions of the bill. Within the study areas, no Measure 37 claims within that 10-year period while the local government figures out where to put the UGB. However, there's an exception in there, too. If you would otherwise have a valid Measure 37 claim, you're within one of the study areas, you can subdivide. I'm trying to remember now. This is in Section 18, page 14. You can divide the property down to 20 acres, so you can create new lots or parcels. Moving on now into the miscellaneous provisions, page 15, sections 20 and 22, new residential development in certain areas and any residential development authorized pursuant to Measure 37 would be limited to 500 gallons of domestic water use per residential unit per day. I don't know how many of you are familiar with water law, but there's currently an exempt use, domestic use. You can use up to 15,000 gallons of water per day for domestic use without any kind of permit or regulation by the state. Especially in areas that are groundwater limited, as designated by the Water Resources, and critical groundwater areas, the potential for essentially unregulated and unlimited new water use by residential uses was thought to be a problem, so we addressed it in this bill. Dealing with appraisals, the Department of Administrative Services, in implementing Measure 37, has adopted some guidelines for appraisals and how to determine reduction in value. We codified that structure, direct DAS to adopt guidelines for appraisals and statements of reduced value, and then direct the appraisers board to authorize appraisers to issue what we call a statement of reduced value consistent with these guidelines. It's intended to be an appraisal light, so an appraiser can go out and determine whether or not there's been a reduction of value without incurring all of the cost and inconvenience involved in an actual appraisal. Section 26 would set aside view corridors for restricted development along the lines of the view corridors currently found in the Forest Practices Act. And then the compensation mechanism begins at Section 28. And there's a prospective and a retroactive aspect to the compensation mechanism. Retroactively, this would apply to properties that currently receive special assessment, beneficial assessment under the EFU farm deferral, the non-EFU farm deferral, forest land deferral. This is, when I say deferral, is referring to deferred taxes. Small woodlot deferral, open space deferral, wildlife habitat deferral, and the riparian land deferral. When a Measure 37 claim is approved on any of these lands, the back taxes that would otherwise, that normally become due when these properties are disqualified, would then become due. The revenue then is divided up between cities and counties after accounting for what the school districts have to get under the Constitution. The remainder is divided between cities and counties. That increment between what the land was paying under special assessment and what it would
pay then after the special assessment is removed, that increment is then identified, and for some number of years as yet undetermined into the future, that tax property tax revenue associated with that increment would also be set aside in the property in the compensation fund. So this is how we make, at least for cities and counties, money available to actually pay compensation claims. Charlie, do you want to touch on the connection to the House, the revenue raiser for the state? It's not drafted yet.
The bill hopefully will refer to a House bill that will specify certain revenue-raising measures when new development occurs because of Measure 37 claims. And that's in draft, and I hope will be dropped this week or early next week.
And that one will, this bill, 1037, will generate compensation revenues for cities and counties. Significantly, that leaves nothing for the state. So that House bill is intended to create a revenue mechanism for the state to pay compensation claims as well. So that's the summary. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Committee members, are there any questions for Chris Crane about the summary?
Very briefly, you didn't mention it, but in your summary, I see in whatever that word is, number 10, this bill would be retroactive.
Oh, in the summary. Yes, the applicability clause, last page on my draft, it's section 50. We would apply this. The provisions of this measure and amendments to Measure 37 to claims filed on and after January 1, 2005. So anything filed this year. Those claims that I don't think that there have been any decisions issued on those claims yet. It's just the ones that were issued or were submitted in December.
Okay. Director Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I appreciate the invitation to be here with you this morning. I have seen the draft that Chris reviewed with you this morning. Of course, none of us have seen the dash twos in any kind of LC form, so my purpose this morning will be more general in my testimony. First of all, I want to acknowledge the difficult task that you have undertaken relative to ballot measure 37. I think the difficulty of that is recognized in that we have a ballot measure that passed in November with a rate of 61% voting in favor. By the same token, as was disclosed by a recent statewide land use survey that was released a couple of weeks ago, we also show about two-thirds of Oregonians expressing strong support for property rights relative to land use. At the same time, about an equal majority expressing support for the protection of farmland, and a strong majority of Oregonians expressing support for land use planning through zoning and regulation. And so you have out there, I think, among the public some mixed senses of how Oregonians perceive and want to go forward with land use planning. All of that makes this, I think, a difficult environment within which to work. Having said that, I think the work that is expressed in this bill and the work in progress that is the Dash 2 amendments is also important. At the department, we sort of see ourselves as ground zero for ballot measure 37 in the state. We have, at this point, we're pushing 400 claims coming into the department across the state for compensation or waiver under ballot measure 37. We think that's roughly half of the claims filed statewide. We know that a couple of counties, Washington and Clackamas in particular, both are receiving claims in excess of 100 claims within those counties themselves. And so you have already a strong tide of claims having been filed. And as we begin to evaluate those claims, last week having issued our first draft reports and recommendations on those, I think what we are going to see in the coming months and years if nothing is done is an uneven result and implementation of ballot measure 37, not by any design on the part of government, but by application of the text of the measure to the facts and circumstances that come forward to us. For some, I think they will find that the measure gives too little. Those who believe that they were going to get something may well be disappointed in the context of several claims to find that they may not get as much as they had hoped that they would get. For others who supported the measure, I believe that they may find that the measure gave too much. And so I think we have the opportunity here to bring some clarity and some consistency in the application of ballot measure 37 through Senate Bill 1037 in such a way that captures the public sentiment that underlies support for the measure, but at the same time mitigates some of the more untoward and uneven applications of the measure. That, I think, is all to the good for Oregonians, for the public, for those even who supported the measure. In terms of process, looking at it from the government side, I think this bill has some important elements to it that will address issues that we are seeing in terms of process and potential liability to the state as well as to local governments in going forward under the measure. Chris, in his summary, mentioned the issue of transferability. We know that that is at least a highly uncertain question under the measure as to whether rights are transferable or not. That is a right that a claimant has received through a waiver. That leaves claimants in an uncertainty that will likely not be resolved short of legislative clarification for at least a couple of years until the first case makes its way through the courts to the Court of Appeals and probably to the Supreme Court. That's not good for Oregonians who need to know what they have with this measure and what their rights are. Clarification there, I think, would be greatly beneficial. For those of us in the business of processing Measure 37 claims, I think there are some substantial benefits to be obtained through legislation. One of the issues that we are seeing that is particularly complex is the relationship between state and local regulations, question of authority to waive, who has authority, and coupled with that, even more importantly, who has liability. Under the measure, does local government have potential liability even though local government may have waived application of land use regulation? And at least there is an argument to be made that, in fact, they do. I think that's not an outcome that would have been intended. And I think the clarification as to the relationship between state and local governments and their authority to waive and with that, the liability and the ability to excuse liability to state or local government is very important. Also, Chris mentioned in his summary the authority to waive statute. We have taken the position on advice from the Department of Justice that the measure more likely than not does give state agencies the authority to waive state statutes. Richard Whitman from the Department of Justice has said on the record in the House Land Use Committee that it is that opinion is not free from doubt. We know that we are receiving comments already from claims coming in of objectors to claims who are raising the question as to the authority of the department or a state agency to waive state statutes. What does that portend? That portends the possibility of legal challenges to a decision made by the department to waive a land use regulation based on statute. with the prospect then that that decision could be held up through process of court appeals, and ultimately a possible outcome if that decision, if that authority should be overturned and found not to exist under the measure, the likelihood or the probability of liability then to the state for compensation, because at that point then waiver is not an option that can be granted to the department. Those are all circumstances that are potential under the measure that really will require, I believe, clarification, that could benefit from clarification by the legislature. Otherwise, we will move forward in good faith to the best of our ability, interpreting and applying the measure on a case-by-case basis and developing law over the next several years, in the meantime leaving citizens uncertain as to where they stand with respect to their rights under the measure and how it applies. I believe that a bill such as the bill you have before you in terms of its broad outline presents the opportunity to capture the essence of what the voters were expressing with their vote in favor of ballot measure 37, recognizing the value of property rights, also balancing that against public interest in protecting Oregon's agricultural economy and conserving our livability of communities and open space. I believe that we can strike that balance, and I think that what you have before you is the beginning, or I should say a second step in that process of achieving that balance. Again, I recognize how difficult it is in the environment in which we are working, especially in these months so shortly following the adoption of the measure. By the same token, now with experience at the department of having these 400 claims in process and recognizing the substantial issues both in terms of public policy and legal interpretation that remain to be resolved, you have an opportunity to weigh in and use your proper authority through the legislature to provide clarification, to provide sideboards and guidance, to give to the voters the essence of what the of what they were saying they wanted with ballot measure 37, but to do so in such a way that is sustainable and can be properly implemented by the state and local. I'll just leave you with a couple of comments on where we stand at the department. This will give you a sense of just how big this wave is. We now have, as I mentioned, we're pushing 400 claims through the department. About 84-85% of those are claims for land divisions of one form or another. Just short of 15% appear to be claims for one house on a parcel, and then there's a small subset of other claims as well. So that's how our claims are breaking down. With those 400 claims, we have now devoted 17 members of my staff to evaluating ballot measure 37 claims. At the end of March, that amounted to about 6 full-time equivalent positions devoted to the review and evaluation of ballot measure 37. We are looking to the Ways and Means Committee in this session for funding for some delimited duration positions to provide us with a staff for the next biennium to accommodate what we believe will be an increasing volume of claims coming in. My travels to other parts of the state and conversations with county planners and county elected officials in particular tell me that counties are dealing with the same workload issues as we are, and so I think you have the need out there to provide some clarity that will be well received and serve a good purpose both for the people of the state and for those units of government that are charged with implementing the measure as well. So with that, I'll stop and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Lane, of the claims before the state, do you have any estimates of the total dollar amount of those claims?
I don't have that. I will say it is hundreds of millions of dollars easily. Having said that, I need to qualify that because those dollar amounts would be taken only. We don't have verification of those dollar amounts. They would be taken just from the claim documents. And so they would be untested and untried. But clearly we are in the hundreds of millions of dollars in terms of amounts claimed for compensation. I should also mention that with no compensation fund having been identified, we are proceeding at this point on the assumption that short of legislative action to establish a compensation fund, we will not be paying claims, but we'll be waiving all valid claims.
Assuming you have the authority to waive.
Mr. Chair, that is assuming that we have the authority to waive.
Okay.
That is correct.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Okay.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much, Lena.
Commend your work, and I have had the privilege of being in some of the discussions around about Senate Bill 1037, and will continue to be at your call to provide such assistance as we're able.
Thank you very much. Dave Honeycutt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I was hiding in the back hoping you wouldn't notice me.
You were on our list, though.
Yeah. I think. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. I don't think it's any secret that there have been a number of us working since December on not only on this issue, on ballot measure 37, but also to take a more holistic approach and to look at some of the underlying issues that led to the passage of ballot measure 37, and to look at some of the changes that we could agree need to be made to the existing system to address some of those underlying concerns. A lot of listening to Director Chatterley's comments, a lot of the speech he gave, I would have probably delivered in 1975 on a bill to make changes to Senate Bill 100. But unfortunately, it seems over the last 32 years we haven't been able to get there. And so part of the process behind the group that's been meeting is to not only look at Measure 37, but also and see if there's a better way essentially to build a mousetrap, but also to look at some of those underlying issues as well. And so the group is composed of a fair amount of what I call what I refer to as certified smart types, along with Chandler and myself. And I appreciate Senator Ringo your time spent in that group. We've put in an inordinate amount of time into this process, probably more than we did in 2001 after Measure 7 had passed. And so I'd hate to see all of that work go for naught. The group, the folks in that working group that have been working on this, I believe will ultimately be able to come up with a bill. We've all agreed to put down our swords in an effort to try and end what has been 32 years of divisiveness and heartache and trouble for all sides. Unfortunately, I don't believe that this current draft reflects the consensus of either the folks that have agreed to put down their swords, and certainly not our organization. There are a number of provisions in here that I think we could certainly agree with, and there are a number of provisions in this bill, and it's a lengthy bill that we certainly at this point would not agree with, and therefore I think this bill, if this was the bill, we would oppose the bill. However, I also think it's very important to continue having this discussion, and I also think it's very important to try and get this bill moving. And so we would be supportive, our organization would be supportive of moving this bill or a form of this bill over to the House side while we continue on. It's May 9th or 10th, and I know we're running out of time, and so in an effort to, I think the discussions need to occur, and they certainly are continuing to occur, and the work is continuing to occur. And believe me, if you knew what we were talking about in December versus what we have now, you'd understand that there's been a significant amount of progress made, and I hate to see all of that hard work and progress go for naught. So we would support moving this bill out over onto the House side, but if this bill was the bill that came out of the House side, we would oppose the bill. look at. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Dave. I know that there are some provisions of this draft that you find unacceptable. Do you think that the general approach is in the right direction?
Mr. Chair, yes, I do. There are going to be, and I think we all recognize, in order to get a piece of legislation out that addresses not only Measure 37 but also some of the past problems with the land use system, there are going to be folks. There are going to be winners and losers. I think we understand that. Nobody would be at the table if there wasn't that recognition. And of course, this bill or a form of this bill, I think, will obviously create that. I wish that it was different, but I don't see any other way no matter what side of this issue you're on. And so, the direction we're going is okay, is certainly something I think that we could support, but there just needs to be, from our standpoint, there needs to be some changes, some real policy changes here as far as the types of land that we're talking about.
Okay. One of the things this version contemplates is moving land that is currently designated EFU, but of soil types class 7 and 8, moving those types of lands to non-resource land, or at least leaving that decision to the counties to decide. And that would apply to a property owner, even if they didn't have a Measure 37 claim, but essentially stating that we want counties to have more say over what will happen to the land in their own counties. Could you comment on that, please?
Mr. Chair, the secondary lands, and I don't think it's any surprise anybody who's listened to me testify or been forced to listen to me testify from 1997 and on, and then folks for all the years before me, the secondary lands issue is the biggest flaw in the current land use system. The idea that we've managed to zone 97% of our privately owned rural land as farmer forest land, regardless of whether or not you're capable of doing anything with it. And that's an issue I think that everybody recognizes is problematic. And so the fact that we are addressing this, that issue in this bill, I think reflects the notion that not only are we looking at 37, but we also need to look at some of the underlying problems that led to the passage of Measure 37. And so we absolutely are very supportive of that concept, and that's one of the keys, I think, for any type of legislation to move forward. You can't just look at 37 in a vacuum. If you look at 37 in a vacuum and don't address the underlying issues, then you may deal with 37, but 2 years or 4 years or 6 years or 8 years down the road, the same problems are going to be there.
Okay. This bill contains somewhat of a compensation mechanism in recapturing some of the farm and forest deferral, but it also references a House bill that will contain a separate compensation mechanism, and we've talked about that relating to capturing the incremental increase in value for some of the new development that may occur. Are you prepared to advocate for a compensation mechanism that will be part of this piece?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. You read the first six or seven words of the ballot title for Measure 37, and the ballot title reflected both in the first six or seven words of the caption reflected both the idea that there's going to be a compensation component, along with the idea that there's going to be waivers in lieu of compensation. And so we have said, and I said during the campaign, and I certainly have said every opportunity post-campaign, that we believe that compensation needs to be a part of any piece of legislation, and we'll certainly advocate for that. That being said, if I read the politics of this building correctly, on this issue, I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to figure this out. Anything that takes from the existing general fund is going nowhere, and anything that raises taxes or fees or whatever probably has a difficult road as well. So what we like is the idea of taking of capturing some of the increase resulting from waivers under Measure 37, capturing some of that increased revenue and dumping that into a compensation fund and then targeting that compensation fund according to however the other folks think it ought to be targeted, as long as the we can use Measure 37 in a positive way from the conservation community's perspective to generate increased revenue, we'll go to bat for that and support that kind of concept, absolutely.
Okay. That makes sense in the bill. It also makes sense in the context of Measure 37 because that was a fundamental part, was compensation.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Any questions from the committee? Senator Byer?
Thank you. Dave, would you be able to go through this bill or this draft and tell us the parts you like and parts you don't like?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, this will take a while. I'll be more than happy to do it if you want, but it'll take us a while.
Senator Byer, is it okay if
he meets with you after the hearing and goes through it item by item?
That'd be fine.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Shields.
I would hope that he would be willing to do the same with me at some point in time. I realize
Senator Shields, absolutely.
It'll take a lot of time. I'd even be willing to sit down at the same time that you meet with Senator Byer, but I would like to have the opportunity to do that.
Yep. Senator Atkinson says he might want to sit in on that meeting,
can't
too.
Do it. Wouldn't that be a quorum?
That'd be a quorum.
Could you just, why don't you just give us the two-minute version?
Sure.
Dave? Tell us the parts that you think are going the right direction, and if you had to point to the two or three or four parts that you have a significant opposition to, which are those parts?
Well, Chair Ringo, without cornering myself, this may not be, this list may not be inclusive, but let me go through at least the parts that give us real trouble.
Just to clarify, you're going to work off the 5605 draft?
Chair Ringo, Senator Shields, yes.
Okay, just wanted to be sure.
The list of exemptions to Measure 37 that starts on page 2, we are not sure under, I guess it's J, whether or not we'd like to see the maps and the definition of adjacent lands when we're talking about designated scenic waterways. I understand those maps are available, and we'd certainly look at that. H on the Columbia River Gorge scenic area, we are thinking about, obviously, and we may have a problem with that. Just the exemptions as a whole and the increase in the exemptions, we certainly want to take a look at much more closely than we have to date. We just haven't had enough time to go through those. There's a provision in the draft that deals with a threshold, I believe that's still, yeah, it is, on page 1, section 1, there's a 10% threshold provision in the measure on prospective claims. We will oppose.
You said which page?
It's page 1, section 4, sub 1. There's a 10% threshold on prospective claims. We will oppose a threshold on prospective claims,
and
don't believe that needs
just
to be
to comment. I've had many people say 10% is way too low. It ought to be 25%, like Texas has. Because if Texas has 25%, they must be right. Those are emails I've been getting, Dave.
Mr. Chair, I understand that.
Okay, go ahead.
The question, however, was what is it that we would oppose?
Understand.
That's
understand.
Something that we would oppose. And C, excuse me, section 5, or section 4, subsection 5C, that's page 3, little c, the 60 days, the requirement the claims be submitted within 60 days is too low. It should be larger. it should be a higher number, somewhere beyond 60, 180, maybe a little more.
For a supply challenge?
That's right. And that's the same for subsection 5A that starts on page 2 and ends on page 3. The definitions in page 5, section 6, the definition of land use regulation in sub 3, these are the types of regulations that give rise to a 37 claim, I think needs to be a little bit more inclusive. There needs to be a mention of regulations by the Department of Agriculture as well in that list of land use regulations, and I don't see that there, so we would advocate for that.
Excuse me, Mr. Crane, do you want to...
Dave, 3H, there are statutes contained in ORS Chapter 561. Is that in your draft?
There's not an H on here.
No, we don't have that. Sorry.
That's the new H.
Yeah, the new H.
This is what I submitted to. Yeah,
okay. Thank you, Dave.
So we would advocate for that. It sounds like it'll be in a subsequent draft. The claims process piece, section 7. Sub 2 or sub 3F. A list or description of the land use regulations that the owner alleges restricts the use of property. We think that's an important component that the property owner let the local government know which regulations limit their ability to use their land. We're a little concerned about the language there. However, oftentimes when you're talking about a statewide system with regulations both at the state and local level and in the regional, in the case of the Portland Metropolitan Region, regional level, it may be difficult and maybe almost an impossible task for the property owner, him or herself, to ascertain all of the restrictions that could potentially limit their ability to use their land. Not a big objection, but one that we may want to look at tightening the language up. And I know I'm missing some on here. I didn't bring my marked up version with me.
How about spending a minute or two on the parts of this that you like?
Okay.
Chair?
Yes?
Recognizing he has not gotten to all the parts he doesn't like yet.
He made that clear from the beginning.
Right.
It was not inclusive.
Right. Mr. Chair, the obviously one of the issues that we like on the measure is the transferability issue. That's an issue that we believe we'll be successful on if we have to litigate. But I think Director Shetterly is right that the litigation of that issue may take a fair amount of time, and I would suspect his timetable is probably right, at least 2 years. And so resolving that and getting that issue resolved legislatively certainly I think helps everybody, including our folks who have filed claims already. And so we like that. We also like very much the issue on secondary lands and the fact that we're not just talking about the scope about 37 claimants with secondary land, but we're also just making a recognition that there are areas out there that aren't matters of statewide concern when you're talking about soils and particularly when you get into eastern and southern Oregon. I've heard Senator Atkinson talk about this quite often, and I think that's the case, that there's land out there that isn't farmland, and this bill attempts, although we don't think it makes the right call, but it certainly recognizes that concept. And if this bill passes, there will be, if in this form or another form, I think there will be a recognition that there are secondary lands out there, and that resolves a debate that should have been resolved years ago. So we like that very much as well too. And I think those are the two real driving forces, along with the along with the idea that this gets this moves the ball further and hopefully gets people accustomed to the idea that we can't go out and call everything farmland and expect it to be so. So those are the parts that we really like about this draft.
Senator Byer, do you want him to continue with the other parts that he wants to work on? Because I do want this to be a productive discussion, and we have a number of people that still need to testify. But if you want to, do you want to spend more time on this,
Mr. Chair? I guess I just wanted him to hit the highlights of the parts he doesn't like, and
give us a couple more highlights.
Instead of going by a line by line, Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, the parts that we obviously have trouble with are the definitions on retroactive claims outside of the urban growth boundaries, on the limitations on retroactive claims, and the distinctions drawn between type A, B, and C farmland. I think the type A, B, and C approach is certainly a good approach, but we just disagree where the lines are drawn in this current draft and don't think that that's reflective, at least of what the consensus of the majority of the people that have been meeting and talking about this, where they would fall. And so we'd like to see some amendments, and we'll be advocating for amendments to that. The forest land, retroactive forest land issues need to be fleshed out, I think, in a little more detail. We certainly don't support the current language in this bill, and think that there needs to be an ongoing discussion with folks that are outside of this of the group on forest land issues, simply because most of us in there don't have the expertise to deal with those issues, and so that's another issue that we'd like to see dealt with. We aren't supportive of the elimination of claims from January 1 forward. If people have filed claims in good faith and now have those claims taken away, I don't think we're certainly not at this point ready to support that concept either. And then on the retroactive claims inside urban growth boundaries, the list has been narrowed to residential uses, which we would be supportive of, but the limitations on those the sideboards put on those we're not supportive of. There are the concept that we would support is Goal 5 type regulations, and I don't, people who lost the right to put a home or divide their property and for residential purposes inside urban growth boundaries based on Goal 5 type regulations, and this draft puts additional sideboards on there that I think takes away takes away claims on folks that we believe would certainly have 37 claims.
Okay. I have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under the definitions section on page 2, sub K, the restrictions on mining and use of mineral A resources, you didn't comment on that specifically. Is that something you support?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, reluctantly, I believe that's something that we would support.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the bill.
Any other questions? Senator Shields?
Dave, I really appreciate all that you've shared so far. What I'm wondering about is you said you'd like to keep this ball moving and move it on over to the House. Knowing how much work you've done, and we've been apprised of the work that you've done, and the other certified unsmart person in the back of the room, plus all the certified smart people, given all that work that you've done, would you like to work at perfecting this more on this side before we send it to the other side? What's your thinking there? And why would you want to send it there rather than finish it here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, the timing is the big issue, and the idea that we're running out of time. We don't really have a preference one way or the other. Just knowing, however, that I believe on the House side, there's been almost. It's been difficult for the House Committee to move forward on any type of bills or anything based on the knowledge that ultimately they're going to see some type of product and they want to get started. And so I don't think it matters what happens here when it goes to the House side. I think it's going to be amended no matter. Even if everybody in the back behind me all held hands and went over to the House and said, please don't amend this, I think it's going to get amended anyway. And so just getting it forward and getting it over there so they can do whatever they need to do on it and then ship it back, I think is the wisest use of time.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and I think he's right. We've done a lot of good work, made a lot of hard compromises in this draft. But even though we're still negotiating, it is time, I think, to get over to the House and let them start working on it as well. So thank you very much for testing.
Thank you.
John Chandler, Art Schlack, Linda Ludwig.
I'm going to be losing the committee here.
Go ahead. All right. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Art Schlack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And I want to start by commending the chair and working on Measure 37 and bringing a group of people together to sometimes referred to, I guess, in this building as the usual suspects, but people who are interested in land use and representing the organizations that they have that have a integral part of making land use work in the state of Oregon. Let me start out by saying that I think that the draft, which we've just seen at this point, is headed in the right direction. One of the sections that the Association of Oregon Counties is very much interested, needless to say, is process. We have hundreds of claims that are being filed in counties throughout the state, and the two counties that are leading the way at this point, if there is a race for claims, is Clackamas and Washington. As of yesterday, both of those counties are in excess of 170 claims that have been filed in those counties at this point. Most of those are, needless to say, on claims dealing with lands outside urban growth boundaries. I have provided you a copy of a set of principles that were adopted yesterday by AOC's Legislative Committee. Those principles address responsibility as it relates to state and local responsibility for land use regulations. They deal with the claims process considerably. And you'll note on the second page that item number six deals with addresses the question of transferability. The Association of Oregon Counties supports the notion or having transferability addressed in legislation and supports transferability as a concept that we would endorse. Also, call your attention to number seven that talks about a consolidated claims process. We are very much interested in having a, I'll call it a comprehensive claim, so that you get one bite of the apple, so to speak, and that we look at one claim dealing with regulations which somebody wishes to file. And that we don't get a claim one year and another claim the next year and so on at this point.
Did the counties discuss the question of a threshold?
Mr. Chair, the counties did not discuss the issue of a threshold at this point. We have not discussed a number of elements that are in this piece in the draft. However, we did discuss, as I said, a process. And I would just call to your attention, 36 counties have, as you know, have adopted varying processes. And one of the issues that we discussed yesterday has to do with whether the legislation should require notice and a comment period. The sentiment in our legislative committee, since counties have a variety of processes that they've adopted, they would like to see at least optional as to whether you have notice and comment period. We understand, and we also endorse the principle that appeals should be based on the record established at the local government. So if you follow through with what our principles would subscribe, you would only, counties that did not give notice and an opportunity to comment, any appeals of their decisions to court would not be on the record. In other words, new information could be brought before the court in making those decisions. Now, we may reconsider that, but at this point, the principles would call for a local option in terms of that particular requirement. Counties and the draft does not require public hearings. We certainly endorse that as part of the process, again, being that being done at the local level. Finally, Mr. Chair, I would like to comment on the tract of record. That is a concept that the association does support also, and we will give you our word to continue to work at the Senate level and also when the bill goes over to the House on this proposal to try and see if we can't wind up with a clarifications to Measure 37 that works for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Linda, you want to go?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. Would like to take this time to thank the Chair and all his numerous hours of working this bill and trying to bring all the parties to some resolution with something to be able to move to the House. The League of Cities wholeheartedly endorses that effort. And we think that the amendment, the Dash 2 amendment to this bill, definitely moves it along much further in the direction that it needs to go. There are some specifics I can tell you in the bill that are important to us. And just a few I'll cover. The language of the federal exceptions has been critically important to cities and how we deal with that. And we think this last version is better than what we've seen in the prior version and the Dash 1 version. However, I think that we may need to take that a little bit further and connect it to some particular permits as we have with the pollution control exception. And I would make that suggestion today. Another suggestion I could make, this amendment is being added to Chapter 197, and I think it might be something to consider to consider a standalone chapter for this amendment so that it does not get lost in its entirety, potentially a 197A. We've seen the public contracting statutes be divided up as well as several other of the statutes that we have to make it more comprehensive and user-friendly. I think that's a suggestion that could be made today. The claims process and judicial review process, I think, as important to the counties is also very, very important to the cities. And I think with some minor tweaks, we envision what we have, supporting what we have here in the Dash 2 amendments. There's some very, very small minor tweaks there. A couple of last things. We talked in this process about parking compensation claims for a period of time if we were not able to come out with a compensation bill this session. I don't see any language here yet that describes that process. The parking concept we talked about would be for compensatory claims only, not necessarily claims that we could authorize waivers for, but to build an assessment of what the scope and measure and types of those claims were so that a subsequent legislative assembly could make a decision whether or not to develop another compensatory mechanism for those. So I think we believe that idea has some merit and maybe something we don't want to forget about as we move along further with this endeavor. Also, finally, in talking about that compensatory mechanism that the chair talked about bringing forward in the House, the League could support that provision as long as it had a portion of it available for the infrastructure that will be needed in order to service these additional uses on our land.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. I, too, would like to add my thanks to you. And I can't help wondering if maybe during the committee assignment process you're now wishing you hadn't signed up with something easy like health care or maybe redoing the PERS stuff just for fun. I'll be very brief. I think this is going the right direction. It's off a few degrees here and a few more degrees there. There's only one spot that it seems to be going entirely the wrong direction, and that's our little scenic vista piece. But every time I read that, I get the old Chevy jingle, "See the USA in your Chevrolet." But that's if we could do musical overtones to land to legislation, I'd suggest that. And I don't know what your pleasure is, Mr. Chairman, given the time and the number of other people you have to testify, I can walk through where I think some of the grindy noises are. We'll certainly commit to continuing to work on this. I would like, before I go to the grindy noise piece, to underline a couple things. Mr. Honeycutt said that I think very well, 37 is a reaction to a system in some disrepair. We've known this for a long time. We've been unable to get to it. Part of what we've done with our super-duper double probation, not-so-secret work group is to address or try to address some of the underlying causes that I believe brought Measure 37 forward in the first place and Measure 7 before that. There is a bill this session. It was Senate Bill 82, which came out of your committee, Mr. Chairman, is now languishing in the darkened hallways of Ways and Means. I'm not sure in whose darkened hallway, given the split. I'd commend that to you. I think that or something like that desperately needs to occur because we are going to have these gun battles and Congress. Those of you who paid attention, people in this room who have paid attention to land use wars over the last 30 years can see the skirmishes in the Dash 2 amendments. And we have to do this systematically because we're going to do it every permit counter in the state if we don't. Now, maybe Senate Bill 82 isn't the answer. 1037 certainly can't be the answer because it's limited in its scope. But somewhere, somehow, we have got to get our hands around this spaghetti bowl of Oregon land use law. I don't know how many times attempted rewrite, my goodness, I wanted to just go outside and pound my head with a bat because you don't know where to grab. You don't know what problem to start fixing. You don't know which end of the stream you should pull. We've got to fix it. And I think if we don't do it, we are going to see countermeasures and more countermeasures and more fussing in the courts and at the ballot box, which I would submit to you is exactly the wrong place to have that conversation. With that sermon now put aside, the grinding noises, I think, and Ms. Ludwig and others have mentioned, the federal exemption under the current Measure 37, it says that you get, if it's required by federal law, there's no coverage. Well, we all know federal law hardly ever actually requires anything. It tells you to go clean the air up and tells you, we'll let you know how you did later. The language in this draft is closer. I think it still needs some work. And one of the things we might think about, in addition to tying it to specific permits, is to split between natural resource type industries, ag, timber, aggregate, et cetera, and the permitting regimes there, and those that are affecting more of the municipalities and urban developers, because they are different, and I think different enforcement mechanisms and different exposure to federal enforcement may be appropriate. Don't have anything specific other than to think that might be a path worth following. There's also a new exemption that I hadn't seen before in the Dash 2 is regarding scenic waterways and adjacent lands. I don't know what the scenic waterways are, and I'm wondering if they run along the scenic highways, in which case we at least have the list.
the ditch next to the scenic highway,
quite so. Which, under the Corps of Engineers interpretation, are now waters of the United States anyhow, so we're seeing barge traffic coming up those ditches. I'm not necessarily opposed to not developing alongside scenic waterways, whatever they might be. It'd be nice to get a little clearer definition than whatever the Park and Rec Department dreams up. Not that they dream up anything stupid, obviously. That'd be inappropriate. With regard to the farmland issues, one of the things we're trying to do with this is to create, a more realistic view of what is and isn't productive ag land in Oregon. I think the category one may be still a tad broad. I'll leave that to other folks who know that issue more than I. I do know from my years back when farming that not all irrigated land is necessarily land that ought to be irrigated. I think that definition could use some tightening. If what we're really trying to do is protect the good farmland, it doesn't necessarily mean you protect the bad farmland that gets wet every now and again. The category two land is where I think the big fights are going to occur. In my mind, one of the things we're trying to do with Category 2 goes to that broader concept that we were talking about, and that is we've had a system for so many years that was binary. Said you either can or you can't. And I think what we're trying to say in Category 2 is there's some places where you can if. And what we're calling off-ramps, or what I call off-ramps, in between the no you can't of pre-Measure 37 law and the yee-haw of post-Measure 37, trying to say, look, yes, you may have had the right to do X, but here's some other things we can build in, minimum lot sizes, the clustering, getting people to get, allowing them some economically viable use of their property without completely subdividing the state and actually resulting in development patterns that I think those of us who drive through small rural communities find pleasant. They look rural, they feel rural, and could function quite well if we had a system to get us there. Again, I think it's going in the right direction. Some of the numbers, some of the acreage, that sort of thing may need to be tweaked. The concept is a very good one. The issue of clustering is one I particularly like. It needs some definition. It sounds like a candy structure. At this point, there's clearly a way to make clustering work in a way that functions. Part of that, though, is going to be a psychological shift of kicking a lot more of the authority down to the county level, because they're the ones who know where the road capacity is. They're the ones who know where the other forms of infrastructure, stores, churches, schools, et cetera, are. Moving forward to Category 3, I think that's a tad restrictive as well, having grown up in Category 3 territory. About 20 acres of rabbit brush is about 19 acres too much of rabbit brush. I think there's probably a way we can kick more of that down to the local level as well. Again, right idea is still, I think, a little bit too restrictive. On the UGB piece, inside of the wealth boundaries, as Mr. Honeycutt mentioned, the current language says development regulations adopted to implement Goal 5. That's too tight. What we were hoping for was Goal 5-ish. We don't want to get into a magic words syndrome where the local governments regulate stream sites, riparian areas, habitat, view corridors, etc., but because it didn't say Goal 5, then it's off limits. And I think that was a big part of what drove the vote on Measure 37, particularly in the metro area and other places where local governments may have gotten a tad ambitious with the environmental restrictions. The urban fringe piece is an excellent, a very critical part of this, because we have two concerns from the development community. One is that you don't want rings of low-density development occurring outside of urban growth boundaries, because if you have a ring of five-acre mini-mansions with oh-my-God houses right in the middle of it, it makes it kind of difficult to run sewer lines through the game room because those folks have no sense of humor, typically, and you end up leaping over that area, which costs a gob of money for infrastructure and whatnot. We'd much rather have, as the bill contemplates, 20-acre minimum lot sizes so future development can occur. So that's one idea behind the urban fringe. The other is, frankly, and this we're not here yet, but I think we need to get here in the House version, is if you have land immediately outside an urban growth boundary that has a major 37 claim, while rather than compensate or meet with the people about what they can and can't do, probably the smartest and simplest thing in a lot of cases is going to be to bring them inside the urban growth boundary. You make them urban, you make them urbanizable, their property values go up, their claim goes away. I think what we're trying to get to is that concept, and we need to make sure we can, in drawing of these lines and these circles around the cities and the study areas within those circles, make it clear that one of the objectives is you can go out and move the boundary if that's the most sensible thing to do. Now, when you do that, though, you're going to run smack into some other areas of Oregon law, which make moving over the boundary such an entertaining exercise for all involved. I think we need to talk about that. We're not there yet, again, going the right direction. The compensation mechanism, There's one that isn't listed, and that is the possibility of capturing the capital gain uptick. Is a fictitious number derived from even another fictitious number, but what the heck, that's what Ways and Means is good at. If you start with the assumption that's built into the budgets of how much income tax is going to be generated through capital gains, and then anything on top of that gets scooped off and put into a this Measure 37 fund, in my conversations with legislative revenue, that is doable. I don't think they'll warrant exactly how accurate the number is, but there is an ascertainable number. With regard to the piece in the House, I'm not sure which piece is going to be brought forward in the House, and so I'll anticipate a possible question and say that we might support it, then again we might not, depending on what it does. Clearly a compensation pool is going to be necessary. I do encourage you, and I'll encourage the House as well, not to recreate what happened in Measure 7, where my folks got asked to pay a tax to undo the bad things done to rural people, and we didn't think that was a good idea for a number of reasons. Having said that, there are certainly some compensation pieces and some trade-offs that could occur within the construct of this bill that might get us to support that, but I'm not going to give you a blanket love you though I do. One other piece in here that I just caution you about, I think is a grinding noise, is the disqualification for coming out of farm use. Right now it's 10 years. When you come out of farm tax deferral, you have to pay the taxes back. The bill, if I read it right, says you can go back to the date of injury. Is that what it says, Chris? Or the, not the date of injury, but the offending regulation.
Property.
Yeah. Or ownership?
Ownership. So if you bought it
15
years.
That may be a bit rigorous. And I it's not my issue, but you may get some folks that know that stuff better than I that would object. So
why would that be too rigorous? The person's been receiving that deferral ever since they own the property.
Not my issue. I'm just saying, okay. Don't be surprised.
We'll hear from Don Schellenberg. He'll get me straight.
Mr. Schellenberg's never given me his proxy yet. I doubt I have it now, although things would work a lot better if I did. The applicability clause, I think, is problematic. The applicability clause.
Oh.
You do have claims, what I call gap claims, that people have filed. I think politically, legally, I think we can say, whoops, never mind, made you look. Politically, that's a whole different issue. And I think that's going to be something we need to massage. I'm not troubled personally by having a 1037 process and a Measure 37 as written process. But people in the Measure 37 as written, obviously, run the risk of what the courts might do on issues of such as transferability and other things.
Yeah, I mean, if part of our goal is to help resolve some of the uncertainties of Measure 37, it seems to me that we ought to do that for all claims, rather than just the claims that fall after some applicability date.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with that.
I don't have any interest in resolving some of these ambiguities like transferability. For a group that's not going to be subject to Senate Bill 1037. In other words, there's going to be that window in there that they're still going to have their ambiguities, and I don't see how that serves us.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that point, and I'm not unsympathetic to it at all, and I'm not sure, frankly, that I have a dog in this fight. Professionally, my members don't have any claims filed other than they might have filed on their personal behalf. We don't, if we do our jobs right, we don't own land long enough to have a Measure 37 problem. I do think, though, politically, again, that yes, you're going to resolve the ambiguity, but in some parts of this, we are resolving the ambiguity by saying they didn't have a claim. That's different than telling them what the process is. There's ways that I'm just saying, again, grinding noise,
okay.
I don't recommend the outcome.
It will be grinding, I agree.
Yes. The last piece I want to mention, and I want to underscore something that Mr. Shetterly said and both Art and Linda said, and that was the need to really define clearly, and I think we're getting there, but it's not quite there, state versus local responsibility, because we can end up in a loop there that doesn't benefit property owners, doesn't benefit developers, and certainly doesn't benefit the governmental entities if there aren't pretty bright lines, both on the process side and on the who gets to write the check or grant the waiver side, as to who calls the ball. And I think we all understand that. I'm just not sure that we're quite there yet, and I think the most recent, if I read the paper correctly, the initial round of determinations from DLCD certainly to me indicated a slightly different understanding of what the rules were going to be than what I thought, which is neither here nor there, other than the fact, as long as we're clarifying things, we've got to clarify it. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my grinding noise overview. Be glad to take any questions you might have.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate
you.
Your testimony. Bob Stacey, Jessica Hamilton.
Yeah.
Mr.
Chair, members of the commission, committee. My name is Bob Stacey. I'm Executive Director of 1000 Friends of Oregon. As one who has not participated in the work group that has developed these recommendations, I do appreciate the opportunity to briefly comment on the results this morning as part of your overview. I want to join the chorus of those who have participated in that process by thanking the Chair for his dedication and hard work in attempting to move and make progress in an area of great threat to the livability of the state of Oregon, and one that's surrounded by a great deal of uncertainty about how Measure 37 works or may work. The Chair, I am personally persuaded, has been motivated by a sincere desire to protect the state's future to the extent possible and practicable against threats that we all see to that livability resulting from implementation of a poorly drafted measure. And I do commend you, Senator. I also want to thank the Chair for progress made in the Dash 2 amendments in modifying and limiting some of the more harmful provisions of the Dash 1 informal amendments that were circulated last month. For example, the tract of record provisions that apply to the first tier of agricultural lands in this draft are more limited in their scope and are limited specifically to those folks who would qualify for Measure 37 claims, unlike the Dash 1 amendments. We also appreciate the progress that you've made toward a proper definition of evaluation methodology and an approach to evaluation methodology that may yield workable results in terms of actually measuring loss resulting from regulation rather than speculative windfall resulting from an exemption. But there are winners and losers in processes such as this, and I think it's my my allotment to talk on behalf of what are so far some losers. We are gravely concerned about the portions of this bill that make permanent changes to the Oregon land use planning laws. These changes can affect hundreds of thousands of acres of particularly ranch land, of other farmland as well. They grant subdivision rights to Measure 37 claimants on roughly three-quarters of the state's agricultural land is now designated. They make those subdivisions transferable, which means that the one house for every 10-acre subdivisions that are allowed under the clustering concept on Tier 2 lands will be built. They'll be marketable, unlike some of the more speculative and grandiose claims that have been made under the non-transferable mechanisms of Measure 37. There would be more impact on the ground on those claim areas than is likely to occur from the most extreme claims under Measure 37. We, of course, have argued for a much more limited approach to, if you will, built-in waivers, such as those that the Dash 2 call for on high-value land, a single dwelling on tracts rather than subdivision of our agricultural lands. And we've argued for that in the context of a robust and funded compensation program. And I'm pleased to learn this morning that Section 51 is intended as a cross-reference to legislation that would be pursued in the House that could yield a compensation program that would be able to compete, if you will, with waivers to be a realistic alternative for property owners pursuing Measure 37 claims. If the committee does intend to proceed down the road of permanent changes to the land use laws, changes that we think weaken them, I hope you'll take more time in this committee to deal with a couple of aspects of this measure. And I speak only broadly. We've reviewed these provisions. Several members of my staff have since Friday, but we're by no means perfectly conversant with them, so I won't be able to be as specific as I would like. But first, we hope you'll work in collaboration or consultation with the Oregon Department of Agriculture on better protection for large ranches. As a subset of those areas that the bill refers to as Tier 3 or non-resource, to identify those areas of predominantly Class 7 soil that nonetheless contribute significantly to ranching. Oregon country beef is raised on Class 7 soils. Those ranchers deserve protection from sagebrush subdivisions just as much today as they did in 1973 when Governor Tom McCall first invoked that phrase to describe the threat to Oregon's rangeland. Second are the vineyards, filbert orchards, Christmas tree farms, and other farm operations on Willamette Valley hillsides, which deserve more protection than the provisions of 1037-2. We support protecting the entire viticultural region that has made Oregon wines internationally famous. It makes no sense to us to allow two-acre lot cluster developments next to world-class vineyards. And we would again ask that you work closely with the Oregon Department of Agriculture and the Oregon vintners to define mechanisms that better protect the soil base upon which vineyard, nut crop, and other intensive agriculture is pursued, rather than only those parcels that actually have vineyards or other crops planted to them today. There's a separate problem that is related to these two categories, and that is that your definition of non-resource lands includes the statutory designation of marginal land. This, we think, is a mistake, and I hope it's simply an oversight. Marginal lands are a subcategory of exclusive farm use. They were established in the early 1980s. They are not poor land. They are not unproductive land. And they exist only in Lane and Washington counties. But they exist commingled with exclusive farm use designated land, and they're subject to most of the regulations of exclusive farm use land. They're next door to farms in EFU. In Washington County, it's called the AF-20 zone. There are more uses permitted in the AF-20 zone than in the EFU. There are somewhat more liberal division of land provisions that apply to those. Those should be continued, but they shouldn't be converted to non-resource, and we would ask that you treat them as other EFU lands. That is, they would divide into the tiers based upon soil capability classes and other considerations, not simply because they've been designated marginal, which, if you will, was more of a policy than an agricultural land resource determination when it was made, which may reflect the fact that only two of Oregon's 36 counties followed that course. Without casting any stones, I want to make the observation that Oregonians in Action will obtain very significant outcomes, victories, as a consequence of this bill. First, 1037 makes waivers transferable, meaning that those subdivisions, 20-acre lot partitionings, and other developments authorized in this bill will be built, unlike those claims which are not transferable and for which mortgage financing is likely impracticable. This bill eliminates all protection, as I've said, for large areas of agricultural land, long a mission of Oregonians in Action, and one that, as they concede, they can't pass at the ballot box. We don't believe these concessions should be made. Unless they're tied to House action that creates and funds a compensation program for property owners who can show that they actually lost value, and we strongly support a value loss below a threshold, which we suggest is appropriately 25%. Absent that provision retroactively, there's little indication that there's any relationship between harm or injury and the availability of a Measure 37 claim. It's simply how long have you owned the property. There's no compensable loss there. Prospectively, unless you have a threshold that is meaningful, local governments won't be able to plan and zone in this state in a way that even temporarily reduces property value and expect to be able to implement those regulations until the property changes hands. There needs to be some room for negotiation and compromise, and 25% is an appropriate factor, particularly prospectively. It's a fair question, and it's one the chair has asked in hearings on previous drafts of this measure. What if the House does not act? What if you were to follow our advice and tie your activities to House provisions relating to compensation? Is 1037 not better than Measure 37? In other words, shouldn't we take what we can get? I would respectfully suggest that that is not the choice before us, and that, in fact, Oregonians in Action wants a bill
They will do the work in the House necessary to pass legislation reforming Measure 37 because it doesn't work right. But if it comes down to a choice between continued implementation of Measure 37 and 1037, I must tell you it is not clear which is the worst outcome. This past week, as Director Shetterly can explain in more detail, the state issued its first Measure 37 recommendations. That is, his department issued recommendations subject to further review internally before a final decision is made. Those decisions show the results of careful and competent administration of this law. One claimant in Clackamas County, I believe it's the Hoff claim, received county permission for subdividing. However, the state has determined that at most that claimant may be entitled to apply for one single land division and an associated farm dwelling, not a major residential subdivision. And the reason, of course, is because the ownership of that parcel vested after the January 1975 effective date of the statewide planning goals. When that same rule of applicability of the planning goals to actions, even actions that complied with then applicable county zoning, is applied to the infamous Benton claim in Hood River, the 800 lots on 250 acres claimed by that property owner will vanish into a couple of 20-acre land divisions.
Two 20-acre land divisions?
The one that's under consideration now, Mr. Chair, is a 50-acre portion of the 250-acre total ownership, and it's our view that because the ownership vested after the adoption of the statewide planning goals, the same rule as in the Hoff case will apply, and that 55 or 50-acre parcel will be entitled to one land division to the 20-acre parcel size that was later acknowledged for Hood River County.
Okay.
We have attempted to do a test sample on lands affected by Measure 37 to determine how extensive these effects of careful application of the law will be in reducing the potential damage. Henry Richmond has been working with the assistance of Stewart Title, a Portland firm, using its database to review ownership records of a test plot of some 12,200 acres, generally described as south of the Sunset Highway and north of the communities of Forest Grove and Cornelius to the west of Hillsborough, areas on DFU in the county. 12,200 acres takes a while. His associates have been at it for more than a week. Their work is not yet complete, but I wanted to give you at least an opening summary of the results they've discovered so far. There are 252 parcels in this 12,200-acre area. Of those 252 parcels, Mr. Richmond's findings are that 197 of them, 80% of the land, have no basis for a Measure 37 claim because of the length of ownership alone. Only 9 parcels of the 252, totaling 400 acres, or less than 3% of the total area, appear to meet the basic test of Measure 37 with respect to exemption from statewide planning goals, the requirement of continuous ownership since 1975. There are 58 parcels remaining, many of them the subject of trusts, for which detailed microfiche research is still underway. But there's the potential reach in an area immediately outside the regional urban growth boundary that's been under development pressure for a number of years. Measure 37 claimants may be as little as 400 acres out of 12,200 acres. Finally, no one to date has submitted evidence that shows a valid loss of value resulting from the application of the statewide planning laws to agricultural or forest land. Many people have claimed loss based upon the value to them of developing if their neighbors remain subject to the regulation. In other words, the value of an exemption. This gets into the detail of valuation theory, but basically it's the difference between measuring a loss resulting from regulations and measuring the potential windfall that would result if you and you alone are exempted from a regulation, and we think the latter is an invalid and unlawful application of any interpretation of Measure 37. Finally,
and again, not to be contentious, but to make sure we're all realistic about all the prospects ahead of us. We continue to believe that Measure 37 violates the Oregon Constitution and that the Circuit Court of Marion County will so conclude in its final determination, which will be issued sometime this summer. We support reforming Measure 37, not simply invalidating it. But the current measure, we believe, is invalid and will be swept away by the court's decision. It is important to establish an alternative mechanism that meets the fairness objectives of the people of Oregon, that provides compensation when people have lost value as a result of the application of regulations after they acquired the property. We wish to work toward that objective. We wish to work with you and the House to accomplish that. And we're ready to assist in any way that you deem appropriate to replace this fatally flawed measure with a measure that can pass constitutional muster. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Jessica.
Okay, great. Chairman Ringo, members of the committee, my name is Jessica Hamilton, and I'm the Legislative Affairs Director for the Oregon League of Conservation Voters. I'm actually speaking on behalf of the Oregon Conservation Network, which is a coalition of about 80 different organizations in the state that work to counter legislative threats to Oregon's quality of life. So Bob talks about the cows, I'll talk about the critters a little bit more. And we're really thankful for your efforts, Senator Ringo, to incorporate the environmental community into your work. We hope that the feedback that you've received has been helpful in developing your Dash 2 amendments. And some of the comments I have here might actually have been reflected in the Dash 2s at this point, but it's more of a way to reemphasize our concerns, if that's okay. And we definitely appreciate the additions on page 2 under section 4, I guess F through K. And if there are any other comments we have on that, we'll certainly give that to you. But now I'm going to kind of launch into the more concerns area. And we're going to categorize it according to biodiversity areas and wildlife, water quantity, the coast, urban natural resource protection, and then forest, and that Oregon Forest Practices Act, just to kind of give it a breakdown. So it's currently mapped this is under the heading biodiversity areas and wildlife. Non-high-value farmlands and non-resource lands include some of the most important habitats in Oregon, including virtually all oak woodlands, some critical coastal sites, most of eastern Oregon's historic wetlands, and most privately owned rangelands. And it's our understanding that a significant portion of most of the lands identified as high priorities for conservation may be subject to subdivision down to a 10-acre parcel. Such priority conservation areas are places in which biodiversity or species richness is high, habitats are unique, and habitat species are rare or endangered, or are habitats which must function well to ensure healthy ecological processes. In the case of non-resource lands, some of these sensitive areas would be unfortunately eligible for subdivision down to 2-acre parcels with no Measure 37 claim required. So for the same reasons explained...
Yes, sir. I have a question about that. Do you agree with that, Chris? Would they be able to subdivide down to 2 acres?
I don't think so, no. That was changed in later drafts.
Okay.
We've had some debate about that.
I'm sorry. That would be true under the clustering provisions. You could go down to an average of 2 acres in the clusters.
That's right. That's what you were talking about earlier, wasn't it?
That's right.
Okay.
So we can take a look at that and see if we still think it'll have that impact.
Thank you.
And then for the same reasons explained above, deer wintering ranges would be severely impacted under the current draft of Senate Bill 1037 because deer need areas as large as 160 acres for foraging during the wintertime. So the bill currently drafted relies extensively on soil types, and while soil types are reasonable predictors of productivity, they don't tell us enough about biodiversity values and conservation priorities. A classification system that is based primarily on the land's productivity for commodity production will inevitably give short shrift to habitat and biodiversity values. So moving on to water, water quantity. We understand that the term land use regulation is defined in the bill by referencing specific statutes and types of regulation. Items not expressly referenced would be excluded from the definition. But given this approach, it would provide more certainty to specify regulations not intended to be covered by Measure 37, specifically the regulation and management of waters of the state. And this goal could be accomplished by citing all relevant sections of the Water Code and related codes in the exclusion from the land use regulation definition. So regarding, you mentioned the use of groundwater by homes, it may be time to have homes apply for a water right rather than continue to exempt the well system, albeit at a reduced daily gallonage. You had talked about 500 gallons of groundwater per day as proposed in sections 20 and 22 versus the 15,000 gallons, which is currently allowed. And we've just seen in the Umatilla and elsewhere, the concern is that irrigators are taking steps to increase efficiency, but the new subdivision next door is punching multiple new exempt wells that will undermine the benefit of the efficiency measures. So just a couple points regarding coastal areas. As discussed in Section 4, Subsection 3F of Senate Bill 1037-2, exempting coastal shorelands, estuaries, and beaches from Measure 37 is certainly helpful. But what is of greatest concern to groups such as the Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition, one of the members of the Oregon Conservation Network, is coastal sprawl. The coast will be greatly impacted by subdivisions outside of urban growth boundaries. Second point under the coastal heading, when discussing the exemption of estuaries, it is advised that this exemption extend 250 feet back from estuaries. This is a minor point, but one of significance. When developing buffer zones, the accepted method is to protect an area the width of the significant tree height to allow trees such as the sitka spruce to fall within the buffer into the estuary. So on the point regarding urban natural resource protection, although the loss of habitat protection on an individual urban property may seem small compared with potential Measure 37 impacts in the Hood River Valley, for example, or the Steens Mountain Protection Area, habitat loss is incremental. And on an already fragmented landscape, such as inside an urban area, the loss of just a few increments can have significant impacts on ecological viability in those areas. So specifically, Section 17 of Senate Bill 1037 needs to state that the exemptions contained in Section 4, Subsection 3, apply to retroactive claims brought under Section 17. Now, I don't know if that's already been included or not. So in addition, it needs to be clear that all five of the requirements in Section 17, including the one I just mentioned, must be met in order to bring a retroactive claim. So the last issue area I wanted to touch on today regards forests and the Oregon Forest Practices Act. The Oregon Forest Practices Act is the primary implementing mechanism for the Federal Clean Water Act and the Coastal Zone Management Act on non-federal forest lands in Oregon. And as such, claims made under these regulations are not subject to Measure 37. Therefore, the Oregon Forest Practices Act should be exempted from the definition of land use restriction in Section 4, Subsection 11. So current and future water protection rules configuring and limiting management within stream buffers, road standards protecting water quality, and harvest unit size limitations should be declared exempt from Measure 37 claims by either clarifying that they fall into the pollution exemption that you've already mentioned or excluding them specifically in the definition section of the bill. So that was the final point under forests. So just to wrap up, I have described a few of the issues that member groups within the Oregon Conservation Network have highlighted as needing to be addressed in the final version of 1037. And please refer to their submitted comments for more information on those and other pointers they wanted to make. And while each group has specific environmental expertise, there is one overarching concern that the organizations in the OCN share, and that is that under the current version of 1037, it is unclear exactly how much and where additional land is going to be opened up for development. The waiver of land use protections and the subsequent development of Oregon's lands can have severe impacts not only on farm and forest land as traditionally recognized, but also on water quantity, biodiversity, and urban natural resources. So an assessment about whether the final legislation is better than allowing Measure 37 to move forward as written will still need to be made. We will be listening closely to the policy expertise of 1,000 Friends of Oregon for this information and following their strategic direction. So thanks very much for the opportunity to share some of these concerns, and we look forward to working with you further.
Any questions, everybody? Well, I very much appreciate and will take to heart the comments of both of you.
Great.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Ed Sullivan? Ed, you're not a regular down here. I should have had you go first.
That's all right. Chair Rangel, members of the committee, I'm Ed Sullivan, 121 Southwest Morrison, Portland 97204. I'm speaking only for myself today. I thank you and staff and the committee for the bill that's come forward to meet the concerns of Measure 37. And I think it would be accurate to say that both or all parties in the process probably need a bill. And the issue is what kind of bill comes out of there. And I have some observations on the bill itself. I wanted to speak mainly to sections 4.1 and 4.2, which are on page one of the draft amendments. And they relate to valuation. The valuation process here, although it uses the term just compensation, is not like eminent domain. You're not taking a whole property or an interest in a property, but you're dealing with a special voter-approved process which sets up a different kind of valuation. And what 4.1 and 4.2 do is to set the sideboards and the process for that evaluation. And there are a number of policy issues here which the committee should study carefully. There is a need for clarity here because the current process is really up in the air, and as a couple of previous speakers have said, may not be decided for a couple of years until the first case gets to the Oregon Supreme Court. The big thing to know about the valuation is that it's not in a black box, that traditional valuation looks at a piece of property and looks at the regime in which it operates, in which it is found. It looks at the totality of regulations, not only on the property itself, but on the surrounding properties. That is what value is composed of. Having said that, let me move through four issues that come up in the valuation process that the committee ought to look at. The first one is the distinction made between regulations adopted prior to December 2, 2004, and those adopted later. The provisions of 4.4(1) make a distinction between those enactments and those enforcements of previous regulations. Later parts of the bill deal with an issue that I have a good deal of concern about, and that is the establishment of a statute of limitations or statute of ultimate repose. But the distinction made in subsection 1 of section 4 makes a distinction between those that are already in place and those that are newly enacted. It is true that you still have to deal with regulations which restrict the use of real property, and they have the effect of lowering fair market value. The second issue is the threshold. You've already discussed the 10%, which is in the current version of the bill. Some would opt for 25. You all know that Measure 37 did not have any threshold to begin with. There is reason, I suppose, for the establishment of a threshold, and that is that it would take away any speculative or de minimis claims, and also bearing in mind that if the landowner prevails, the landowner gets attorney's fees and costs. And just how far down the line you want to go on that is, I think, the reason for the threshold being established at 10% or being proposed at 25 or some other figure. The third issue you'll see is in 4(2). the new words entire lot or parcel. I believe that that was placed in there, and Chris can correct me, is that you look to, as you would in traditional condemnation law, at the effect of the reduction of the value of the whole parcel. You don't segregate out, for example, the side yards or the front yards being the subject of a zoning or other restriction. And then the last thing is the date that's used. In, again, in 4 sub 2, date is not as of the date the owner makes a written demand, but rather as of the date of the adoption or the enforcement of the regulation at issue. And an attempt to make up for that, instead of having a current claim, is adjusting that value differential to current dollars, so that you look at the before and after, but you look at it before and after as of the date of the adoption of the regulation at issue. I would suggest to the committee, if it hasn't done so already, that it look at the two recent papers done by economists at Oregon State University, Andrew Pantinha and William Jager. Both of these illustrate the difficulties of doing a valuation process where everybody around you potentially could get a similar waiver. I also want to take the opportunity to commend to the committee and to both houses consideration of Senate Bill 82, which would take a long-range view of the entire process, and hope that you will support it. If I can answer any questions, I'd be glad to try to do so.
Thank you very much, Senator Byer.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Don Schellenberg and Lynn Lundquist.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. First, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to thank you for coming and speaking to our Oregon Farm Bureau Board of Directors last Thursday. That was very much appreciated, and the information and the discussion was very helpful and well received by them. I didn't have the latest version of the draft here, so my references, site references, may be incorrect, but that really doesn't make a whole lot of difference here, I guess. For the testimony today, you asked us to comment on things we like about 1037-2 draft and things we don't like, rather than taking a position on the bill, and I'll do that by making comments on various sections of the amendments. Bearing in mind, Mr. Chairman, as you suggested in other venues, in the end, when the bill moves out of committee, we will take a position on the final product based on whether the future of the agricultural industry is better off with 1037 or under Measure 37 as passed. Sections 1 and 12 through 15 are really connected and illustrate where we both support and oppose provisions of Senate Bill 1037. The board and our members clearly understand that granting of waivers under Measure 37 will allow the establishment of non-farm dwellings and other non-farm uses in the farm zones. Because our policy opposes waivers in farm zones, we see the concept in Senate Bill 1037 of not allowing Measure 37 claims on high-value farmland as moving in the right direction. On the other hand, our policy, which we can't change, as you understand, our policy situation is good for a year, and the board doesn't have the authority to change that, only the House of Delegates can change it, calls for a study of the effects of applying the lot of record provisions to high-value farmland, or in this case, tract of record. And the same policy opposes changing the applicability date of 1185 to the 94 date. Since our policy also supports compensation as the alternative to waivers, we would suggest that a concept be added that would allow landowners of Tier 1 property to have the option of financial compensation or a tract of record dwelling. As currently drafted, the bill simply prevents any Measure 37 claim on high-value farmland. We don't think that is fair when the landowner may have wanted a different use of the land than a dwelling. Our board indicated a favorable response to the three-tier concept, reserving support based on details of how farmland is identified for each of the tiers. Just using soil classification may be too simplistic. We believe this deserves some significant study before a decision can be made. I'm aware that the Department of Agriculture has begun assessing other factors that may be more indicative or may present a more complete picture when assessed in conjunction with soil classification. Section 4 provides for exclusions for which Measure 37 claim may not be filed. The Dash 1 amendments that we looked at before excluded claims based on water right law. We strongly support that provision, but do not see that included in this draft. And I don't know what the reason for that is, but we'd like to see that back in there. Sections 4 and 6 both touch on which provisions a public entity has the authority to waive. However, it is not clear to us in the draft if a state agency can waive a statute. The Oregon Farm Bureau strongly opposes violating the separation of power between the legislative and administrative branches of government. If that is not clearly prohibited in 1037, we will oppose the bill no matter the rest of the content. And that would be our position on any bill that allows such a change. Section 11, though incorrectly labeled in the draft I was looking at, is Section 2 in the draft, changes the statutory definition of high-value farmland to provide that all land that is irrigated with a water right or is in an irrigation district is defined as high-value farmland. Generally, that is a good provision, but just because you're in the district may not mean water is available to you, and if you never have water, then in some areas of the state, that land may be worthless as farmland. A more complete definition would be along the lines of what is irrigable. In other words, can it grow crops if it is irrigated? That is not the case for all soils. We would like to see some more information and study on that issue before a decision is made. Sections 12 and 13 create a Tier 3 new statutory zone called non-resource land. It allows significant parcelization of the land. That may be okay in some places, but Farm Bureau is not ready to give away one of Oregon's most valuable agricultural commodities. If you couple the beef industry with the forage industry, and that is where much of the forage is grown and used, the cattle industry is the largest dollar agricultural industry in the state, and much of it, if not most of the beef, is produced on Class 7 and 8 land. Granted, there is range land that is so poor that even if it was given to you, you couldn't turn a profit raising cattle. But there's also good range land, and that's important to the beef industry. Such land needs to be identified and not zoned as non-resource land. An issue not addressed in the draft has to do with spot zoning. The whole premise of the land use planning system is that you group like kinds of activities together in large blocks and exclude other uses as the means of preventing conflict between the uses. The problem with just using soils as your indicator is that Mother Nature didn't neatly lay out all of the different soil classes in neat 1 mile squares, not even 1 acre squares. So under this draft, there may be small non-resource zones scattered all over among the good rangeland and all the other good soil classes, both in and outside the Willamette Valley. The result can essentially be no land use planning at all. We would have to give some very serious thought and would want to tread very carefully on this one. I'm not saying that we oppose non-resource zone, but we believe there would need to be some kind of large block size requirement in order to make it work. Section 14 appears to make provisions for the Tier 2 lands, but reading the draft that I had, at least, it looks like it allows the same partitions and uses as non-resource lands. The Tier 2 land can still be some fairly productive farmland and should not be treated the same as non-resource land. Section 20 appears to address the issue we raised at the last hearing regarding protecting the water source for existing rural landowners, both for domestic and irrigation uses. Thank you for that change, if that's the reason it was made. I believe Section 22 was supposed to address our concern for contamination of the groundwater by additional dwellings in the farm zones. However, it appears to be just a repeat of Section 20. Just talks about water. Doesn't say anything about water quality.
Pardon?
There are separate sections, one for cities, one for counties. They would be codified in different ORS chapters.
Oh, all right. Thank you. I didn't pick up that detail there. Thank you. Finally, another issue that is not made clear in hearing this discussion this morning and is now made clear, transferability. Our Farm Bureau Land Use Advisory Committee recommended and the board adopted their recommendation that we oppose transferability. The bottom line is that our 90-member House of Delegates has maintained a policy statement opposing more non-farm dwellings and other non-farm uses in EFU zones, allowing a waiver under a Measure 37 claim to be sold to another property owner will simply allow more non-farm uses than would otherwise occur. And so that would be the basis why we would oppose transferability in this draft. Just a moment to discuss special farm use assessment. And there's nothing special about farm use assessment. Farm use assessment is simply using the income approach, just like you do for industrial and commercial property, to determine what the value of that land is for farming. Agricultural land is industrial land, just like any other land. Prior to farm use assessment, farmland was assessed on its market value, like a house is. Houses are they're valued based on the law of supply and demand, not on what the value is for any kind of commercial or industrial use. Well, agricultural land used to be assessed that way, and it was not fair at all. It was, again, industrial land should be assessed using the income approach, and that happened in the early 60s, long before statewide land use planning. So on the issue of a Measure 37 claim and the compensation, I think I picked this up, but the the recapture part with Kevin there of farm use assessment, the difference in the values, that only applies to claims other than for a dwelling. Is that correct? The recapture, the tax penalty?
Well, my understanding that the intent is any land that's pulled out of farm or forest referral will be recaptured.
Even for a single dwelling?
It would have to be pursuant to a Measure 37 claim, so if the dwelling was established under a lot of record provision, it would not be subject.
Right.
It's only subject if a Measure 37 claim is approved.
Right, okay. And I think that would be fair.
Okay.
And we support the recapture concept. However, going back to the whole concept of farm use assessment, we believe that the recapture of the tax penalty, the 10 years, is the appropriate time frame, not clear back to the beginning.
You want to keep it 10 years?
Yeah, we'd support the 10 years. Again, the purpose we have the farm use assessment, and then they added the tax penalty as a disincentive to take the land out of farm use. And so we've bought into that, and we've had farm use assessment for that purpose. Would not seem to be appropriate to remove it all the way back.
We need to wrap up in a minute and let Mr. Lundquist testify.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that concludes my comments, except to say again that we'll withhold our position on the bill until we see the final draft.
And, Don, I just want to let you know, I will go over these item by item with our staff here, and if you get us more comments, get them to me or get them to Chris Crane, and we will go through those comments as well.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That applies to anybody in the audience and anybody who's listening. Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will keep my comments fairly brief, and as I talked with you earlier, sort of on a general status, I think we met some attorneys, and I believe that they have sent the draft to Chris. If not, I will soon make sure you did it. Receive it. Some more specifics of the issue. Actually, my purpose here as president of the Oregon Business Association, and Lynn Lundquist for the record, is that, as you know, we oppose this measure. But we did not oppose it saying that what we had was right. We absolutely believe that the land use system had some sore points in it, had some pressure points that needed to be addressed. We have run a poll, and I think you've all seen that at some point, but I want to use it just a little bit and sort of proving some points this morning to try to make some points. First of all, there's been a statement by many that the people didn't know what they voted on in Measure 37. The fact of the polling substantiates that the people did know what they voted on, the polling, which you have a copy of, I believe, for you at this point. Clearly showed that it was very similar to that. And I think that validates. I mean, the reason we did this, we wanted a benchmark from which we could build later on to see what changes might be in the land use process and what the people's belief on that might be. Clearly, the thing that showed out of that poll is that a strong belief in private property rights and a strong belief in land use planning. And I think for this committee's a benefit is simply this. Those are not seen as mutually exclusive, and I think that's the challenge. That's the biggest challenge you have here, is that those are not mutually exclusive. And that's the difficulty you have, I think, in bringing those two together. But I think that has to be done. I believe that your category to the three land classifications you put together is a good start. I don't think that we do not believe that the final word is written on and how those are divided. I think there's some serious problem, particularly in particularly in land one and two. For example, the way that is drafted now, there are certain areas that will be more restricted than even before 37.
In moving to category three?
No, in category, for example, there are lands that you have in your prime definition of anything within an irrigation district, just for an example. You're saying anything within an irrigation district is prime land.
Right.
Well, in fact, there's non-irrigated land within prime land that under present circumstances can be divided under certain criteria. You actually take away that completely.
Okay.
So, in addition to that, I think there needs to be some consideration given to when we talk about prime land in regard to growing seasons. I think I gave your staff a map that's published by George Taylor of the weather, forget the title, at Oregon State University, that is an eye-opener that your committee ought to look at. If you don't have it, I can make it available to you. But it clearly shows the state and what the difference is in regard to growing season and how diverse our state is. The point of that is the diversity of our state should be taken into account. One size fits all, and I know you're not trying to go there, but I really think that's a lot of the problem we've had in times past. I'm going to like a little point out of just the planning, because I think, why is this land use so cockeyed divisive? Why is it so divisive? Well, if you stop and just analyze it analytically, realistically, the trouble is that the majority of the land is owned by very, very few people throughout the state, if you really analyze that. And land use planning is about how to have the benefits for everybody, but the few people bear a lot of the brunt of that simply because they own the land. There's nothing bad about that. The fact of the matter is the aesthetics and all the things that go with land use planning are very valid. But I think that's the difficulty. And if you look at, you may even want to look right now, but pages 11, 14, 16, 18, and 23 of the poll, if you look on there and take three areas, Eastern Oregon, Deschutes County, which is oversampled, and Southwestern Oregon, and just look at the results of those three areas, which is way over half of the state, two-thirds of the state, and compare that with the rest of the survey. I think that'd be interesting to see it, and that's what you're facing. Now, unfortunately, that's the difficulty that you have. In closing, I'd just like to say this. We're here to lend support to make a change, but we're also here to say, make a change. We do not believe that 37, just to let it go, is appropriate. We don't think it's good for Oregon, for regardless of which side of the issue you might be on this. And I think back to the time I was in China, flying on an airplane with President Brady Adams of the Senate, and I was reading the newspaper, and it was about death with dignity in Oregon. And at that point, we were struggling with the fact of whether we're going to put that back on the ballot again. The point of it is this. I absolutely believe that it's in your hands whether you want to see something else come out that I believe will be more devastating than what we have for Measure 37. The death with dignity, let's give you just a quick rundown of how that came about. First time, passed very narrowly. We put it on the ballot again. I was part of that. Unfortunately, I took wrong advice. But the second time around, 60% voted for that measure. 30% or half voted because they believed in the issue. 14% believed because the church was getting too much involved and sort of rebelled against that. And 16% voted against it because you put it on the ballot again. And it's that's not news to you in a sense, and yet I think that's the seriousness of the situation. And I hope that you, Mr. Chair, and your committee have the backbone to not allow that to happen again. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Tom. I appreciate everybody who testified today. I appreciate all the work that all of those people have done on giving input on Senate Bill 1037, and I hope to keep receiving that input from all sides. And that closes the public hearing on 1037, and that closes the committee.